Hey folks, my name is Scott Weingart, and this is the MCRT Podcast. Today, on episode 181, we're going to discuss pulmonary hypertension. Why? Because I saw an amazing article in the Annals, Pulmonary Hypertension and Right Ventricular Failure in Emergency Medicine, and the lead author of that was Susan Wilcox, and she is an ED intensivist down in South Carolina, and she did an amazing job in this article. It's an unrecognized disease. It's an unrecognized syndrome. It could easily cause a clean kill, the patient who came in talking and goes out dead. So it is definitely a topic we need to cover on MCRT that we've been remiss on having adequate information on. So let's get right to it. Let's go to Susan Wilcox. And where do you get this interest in pulmonary hypertension?
When I was fourth year resident, we had a lecture on pulmonary hypertension, and I realized it was the first time in 4 years that I'd heard anything about it. And then when I became a critical care fellow, I was very intrigued that, you know, here's this deadly condition that we spend very little time talking about. And so then when I was an attending a couple of years ago, we had a patient who came in and she got all the, you know, kind of quote unquote textbook perfect medical care, and she died. She coded and died. And in retrospect, she had RV failure from severe chronic pulmonary hypertension. And so all the things that we did to resuscitate her killed her. So, you know, giving her big fluid boluses, intubating her, et cetera, et cetera. It was exactly what you shouldn't have done. And so that was what prompted me to write the article. Her case.
And it was a fantastic article.
Oh, thank you for saying that.
And we'll put that in the show notes. and that brings me to my first question, which is, this is scary because these people may be walking among us unidentified and just acting as ticking time bombs. They're kind of like the aliens from V. So my first question to you is, who should I suspect this in? How do I identify it? What would make me think an undifferentiated patient who just comes into the ED sick actually is the pulmonary hypertension patient?
Yeah, I think that's one of the scariest parts, is that you often don't know. You know, looking at the literature, it's extremely underreported, even when we have all of the data in front of us. And so the most common cause of pulmonary hypertension in the United States is from left-sided heart failure, leading to group 2 pulmonary hypertension.
Hey folks, let me just give you the groupings for pulmonary hypertension. This is the revised WHO groups directly from Susan's article. So group 1 is pulmonary arterial hypertension. This was the one that we previously called idiopathic pulmonary hypertension. These are the patients who will come in on pumps, so they have pulmonologists. They are very infrequently not identified prior to their ED visit. Group 2 is pulmonary hypertension caused by left-sided heart failure. Group 3, pulmonary hypertension caused by lung disease or hypoxemia, aka the COPDers, the obstructive sleep apnea patients. Group 4 is pulmonary hypertension from chronic thromboembolic or embolic disease, aka the chronic PE patients who now have right ventricular failure due to a large PE that was either unrecognized or untreated. And then group 5 is the miscellaneous grab bag, things like mediastinal tumors, sarcoidosis, hemodialysis patients, thyroid disorders, vasculitis. Okay, let's get back to the podcast.
And so anybody who has left-sided heart failure is potentially at risk. But then the next most common causes are from the hypoxemic causes, like COPD is another one of the most common causes, and obstructive sleep apnea is also an increasingly common cause. And so anybody who has any sort of underlying respiratory problems like COPD, any sort of interstitial lung disease for sure, and some of the rheumatologic diseases like lupus, sarcoidosis, et cetera, those kind of conditions really predispose people to pulmonary hypertension. So those are the ones that where I already have a high index of suspicion just from, you know, knowing a little bit about their history. The other ones that are probably the patients that are under-recognized are the patients who keep coming in with dyspnea without a clear cause. And so there are a little bit of data that those patients but they might have pulmonary hypertension that no one has picked up on. It's been documented that it can take up to 2 years for people to diagnose somebody correctly with pulmonary hypertension. And so any of those people who keep coming back and no one can find a clear diagnosis, those are definitely cases where I'm worried that that patient has undiagnosed pulmonary hypertension or maybe even some element of RV failure.
Now, in your article, you made a point, I think a couple of times, to point out that if someone comes in with dyspnea on exertion or syncope or the combination of those, that's a group that we should really, again, have a high index of suspicion. Is that true?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that in reading a lot as I was studying this and getting ready to write this article, I really changed my own practice because, you know, previously, you know, the patient comes in with syncope or dyspnea and dyspnea on exertion, and, you know, you do all of the right things. You get the EKG, you check the troponin, you might even check a BNP, the chest x-ray, maybe even a CT scan to look for a PE. When all of that stuff comes back reassuring, you know, I always felt good, like, okay, we're done. We've given them good workup and everything looks fine. Now I'm realizing that probably we should be more worried, certainly with the patient who might have a pulmonary hypertension and syncope, but then even our patients who have a good workup, those are patients that I'll now refer to echocardiogram as an outpatient.
So that brings me to my next question, which is, okay, let's say we have a suspicion. How do we screen in the ED?
You know, I think that it's actually getting easier now to screen as more and more of us and our colleagues are becoming more facile with our bedside cardiac ultrasound. And, you know, again, recognizing some of the limitations of doing our own ultrasounds, but also knowing that people are getting better and better. Taking a look with the ultrasound can actually give you quite a bit of data right there. You know, the classic findings of pulmonary hypertension on an ultrasound are that when you look in the parasternal short axis, rather than the left ventricle being a nice round circle as it should be, you can actually see the interventricular flattening. And they talk about the D sign. You can see a big dilated right ventricle. You know, the right ventricle should be less than 2/3 the size of the left ventricle. And if it's about the same size, that right there is a big warning sign. I will also give the caveat, though, that using ultrasound in patients with pulmonary hypertension for resuscitation purposes can be a little bit challenging because we know that these people live their lives somewhat volume overloaded. So using the ultrasound to look for, you know, the IVC collapsibility and all that kind of stuff, they're not going to have that. So just as a caveat.
Yeah. Let's put a pin in that because I'm going to hit that a little bit later because we'll definitely talk about that exact fact. Yeah. So, okay, you said they'll have a big RV. They'll have a flattened septum. It's going to have that D sign. Well, you know, in the patient who comes in, dyspnea on exertion or syncope, I'm thinking PE. So my next question to you is, if we did CT angio these people, is there any signs on CT that would, as they read PE negative, would make us think, wow, you know, what this actually was decompensated right ventricular failure?
Yeah, absolutely. So the right ventricle, again, can be dilated on the CT scan. And so if you see an enlarged right ventricle, there was one study that said that if the right ventricle is 90% the size of the left ventricle, that correlates with badness. You know, various bad clinical outcomes. You can see a dilated PA, and the dilation of the PA on the CT scan has also been correlated with PA pressures when patients have had a right heart cath. So there are a couple of findings that you can see on the CT scan that can make you think, huh, even though this patient doesn't have a PE, there's definitely abnormalities here, and this patient looks like they might have some chronic pulmonary hypertension.
And could we assume that radiologists are savvy enough that they would comment on this, it was there, or do we have to look ourselves for this stuff? Is this the kind of thing that your radiologists are just reading just routinely, and therefore if they don't say anything, we could feel good?
That is such a great point. Not necessarily. I can recall a particular case where we had a guy who came in and we scanned him for cancer. We were actually looking for some sort of pancreatic mass because he was complaining of epigastric and lower chest pain, and he'd had a lot of weight loss, et cetera, et cetera. And so the CT scan read came back that he had, quote, an enlarged heart and then nothing else acute. And so the plan had been to, I think we were actually going to put him in our observation unit and do a stress test because he did have the epigastric lower chest pain. And I was sitting there after my shift doing my notes, and I said, huh, an enlarged heart. Let me take a look at this. And I pulled it up, and I saw that he had a massive RV. And the radiologist hadn't distinguished that it was actually RV enlargement, not what we often think of, which is the LV enlargement. And so in seeing that his RV was enlarged and actually looking back and seeing that his RA was enlarged, I called up to the observation unit, put the kibosh on his getting a stress test, and turns out the guy had a congenital heart defect that had never been picked up. He was an immigrant and had never gotten any sort of health care. And if we had put him on a stress test with, you know, pulmonary hypertension that it was untreated and undiagnosed, that could have been a potentially fatal mistake. And that was a big wake-up call for me that, you know, we always talk about the importance of looking at our scans, but it really drove that point home that, again, they might not always call it. They might not always make the comment about it being RV specific.
That is a great case. All right, let's move on to a patient already documented, and in this case, not just pulmonary hypertension, but pulmonary artery hypertension, group one. And the patient says two things. One, I've been coughing up a lot of phlegm. I've had a fever at home, and I don't think my pump is working so well. Help me. Well, how do you approach this patient?
So if the patient has a pump, if they're receiving intravenous vasodilators, pulmonary vasodilators, prostacyclins being one of the most common ones given. This is an absolute emergency. And again, this was something that I don't think I really appreciated when I was a resident a few years ago in emergency medicine. No one had told me that these patients, if they lose their pump, if they lose their pulmonary vasodilator, they can have a rebound pulmonary hypertension, which can throw them into RV failure, and it can start a catastrophic downward spiral. And so if a patient told me, I don't think my pump is working so well, that would be an immediate wait, stop everything. We have to make sure this pump is working. And so the first things that I would do is make sure that we had reliable IV access, try to figure out what was going on with the pump. And this is the time when I would have no shame, I'd have no pride, call for help, try to get in touch with the patient's pulmonary hypertension physician. If I couldn't get in touch with that physician, start calling pulmonologist, cardiologist, anyone I knew who could help me with these pulmonary hypertension medications, because this could be a big issue.
How long would you mess around with the pump before you just started the patient on your own infusion through an IV?
That's a great question. You know, some of the prostacyclins, like epoprostenol, have a half-life of only 6 minutes. So you don't have a whole lot of time if it's not working and that's what they're on. I would probably, you know, see if I could find something immediately reversible that I could do with the pump. You know, I'm talking less than 5 minutes, certainly less than 10 minutes, and then be calling for help, calling pharmacy to see what we can get as far as the medications go. If I couldn't get IV medications as a somewhat inferior but stopgap measure, go ahead and start the patient on an inhaled prostacyclin or inhaled nitric oxide. It's not as good, it's not as powerful, but at least it's something while I'm trying to get help and trying to get the patient settled.
All right, fair enough. Now, as you're doing that, the patient becomes hypotensive, MAP of 50 now, not looking so great. How are you going to manage hemodynamics in a patient with pulmonary artery hypertension?
Great point. So these patients are, again, often trend towards being volume overloaded. And so this would be somebody where I would not want to give them a volume bolus. And as we were talking about earlier, looking with the ultrasound and trying to assess their volume status is going to be near impossible because their IVC will be bulging and everything from the right ventricular failure that we anticipate is going on from the increased pulmonary vascular resistance from losing their medication. So because we want to make sure that we're perfusing the right ventricle well, we have to make sure that we have a high pressure at the aortic root. And so the first thing I would do would be to grab some norepinephrine because it's probably the best one to start with because you want to make sure that you, again, increase the systemic pressures to maintain RV perfusion. I would have a low threshold to start adding other adjuncts on top of it, and probably dobutamine would be the next thing that I would go for. Again, adding the norepi first to make sure that I don't drop the systemic pressure with adding the dobutamine without some sort of alpha agent there. I would never want to give this patient just phenylephrine because the problem with phenylephrine is that it also acts on the pulmonary vasculature and it can further increase your pulmonary vascular resistance. And so even though it's a great alpha agonist and increase the pressure, without giving any sort of beta agonism or any other oomph for the heart, it can just actually increase your PVR and actually be more harmful than beneficial. So my plan would be to get norepinephrine right away and then get dobutamine on top of it to try to augment their cardiac output as well.
Okay, very fair. Let me hit it piece by piece, and you tell me your impressions of each part of this.
Okay.
So fluids, we said we can't use ultrasound because the IVC is always going to be plethoric in these patients, regardless of their volume status. So how do we know, should we give fluid or not?
That's the key question. It's really, really hard to know. Looking back through the literature, and a lot of this, again, is, you know, observational studies, case reports, et cetera, most people recommend avoiding giving fluids in these patients unless you are certain that they had some sort of precipitant, you know, that they're having some sort of hemorrhage, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, you know, where their volume down. Otherwise, you probably shouldn't, because really the physical exam and all the things that we usually look at for volume status are just not going to be reliable.
Love it. Okay, so that's easy. Don't give fluids unless there's an obvious source of whole body loss. Pressors. Now, you went for norepi. That would have been my first choice as well. Some would argue vasopressin, no pulmonary vasoconstriction. And now with the VANISH trial just published, maybe a titratable agent. Should we be using vasopressin as our first line?
You know what? I was thinking about that as I was talking about it. I'm pro vasopressin. I would never judge anyone for using it. You know, I think that collectively we have a lot of experience using norepinephrine and using it as a titratable agent, and maybe just a little bit less experience. Certainly in the emergency department, we add vasopressin. We don't often start with it. And so kind of thinking about it from a systems-based practice, that was one reason I went straight to the norepi. If someone used vaso, I love it. I'm on board with that too.
All right, now let's go to inotropes. You said dobutamine. We have two other choices that have to be in the mix for consideration. We have milrinone and we have epinephrine. What is your feeling on those two?
Milrinone, sure. You know, I was raised into a dobutamine family. I was brought up with dobutamine, but milrinone also works really well, has very similar effects. You know, again, just like with the dobutamine, you'd want to make sure that you have some sort of agent that's not going to allow you to get all vasodilated and drop your systemic vascular resistance. But you got milrinone, you're comfortable with milrinone, great. And then with epi, so epi, also a great choice for a lot of cases. My only concern is that, you know, and it's kind of six, one half dozen the other with tachycardia for dobutamine and epi. Both of them can cause dobutamine. Both of them can cause, tachydysrhythmias and tachycardia. And so if these patients start to get too tachycardic, one of the problems is that they lose all of that filling. And then even more so than other patients, they really can't tolerate it. So epi is also reasonable, but with both epi and dobutamine, I should put out the caveat that you really want to make sure that they're not getting too tacky and they're not getting any dysrhythmias.
Perfect. Now, these patients are fantastic for permissive hypercapnia and a little bit of hypoxemia, right? That just makes things much better for their situation, right?
Yeah, that's exactly not the case. So that's one of the challenges here, is that, you know, so many of the things that we do in the emergency department kind of go out the window when you're dealing with a patient with pulmonary hypertension and potential RV failure. You know, we are great resuscitationists, and we're taught to be aggressive, give fluids, intubate early and often, et cetera, et cetera. And so many of those things are damaging in these patients. And so when we see these patients, we want to make sure that we're correcting hypoxemia, giving them supplemental oxygen, because the last thing we want is to have them have additional hypoxic vasoconstriction on top of whatever is causing them to have a high PVR. And so wanted to correct their oxygenation and ventilation status as much as possible. But if you intubate them, you're doing a couple of things. You have to give them a sedating agent, and so many of them will still drop your systemic vascular resistance, thereby worsening the whole problem with hypotension and not perfusing the RV. And then you put them on positive pressure, and you're going to further exacerbate the whole hemodynamic problem. And so it's very common that these patients will be the ones that will, you know, code on induction. And as an aside, my suspicion is that, you know, over the years, we've all seen the patient who comes in and they look kind of sick, and we're resuscitating them and they're getting worse, and then we intubate them and then they code. And what I wonder is that for a lot of those patients where we thought, you know, I don't really understand what happened, if a lot of those patients had pulmonary hypertension and RV failure.
I totally agree. The intubate and die, I think they are absolutely unrecognized pulmonary hypertension in a good number of those cases. Before we get to the intubation question, because that's actually the last one I have for you, let's just talk about atrial fibrillation. We should just leave it and tolerate it, right?
Yeah, again, absolutely not. So these patients can sometimes be hanging out, you know, they live right on the precipice. A lot of them just like have like just enough margins on either side. And then if they go into atrial fibrillation, again, they just absolutely cannot tolerate it. They need all of their ventricular filling they can get. They just can't handle being in a dysrhythmia. And so these are patients where I would have a very low threshold of trying to cardiovert them sooner rather than later, either electrically or chemically. And again, with the caveat that giving them a significant amount of sedation and either dropping their SVR or causing them to retain a little CO2 or get a little hypoxemic could be very dangerous as well.
Yeah, it's you're always walking the precipice in these patients. So let's talk about some tightrope walking. Your patient we had spoken about with the pulmonary artery hypertension, her sats are now in the low 80s on high flow O2. You had an x-ray back. She has a clear pneumonia superimposed on everything else. You tried high flow nasal cannula or non-invasive, trying to stave off the inevitable. Didn't work. You got to intubate. You don't want to, but you have to. What is the safest way to make it happen?
You know, I looked a little bit in the anesthesia literature to try to see if they had I looked at this question, because obviously our colleagues in anesthesia have to deal with this not infrequently, how to safely intubate patients with pulmonary hypertension. Some recommend giving the patient topicalization and doing an away fiber optic. You know, in patients who are in respiratory distress, clearly that's a very different patient population than the patient with pulmonary hypertension who's getting a relatively elective OR case. So I don't really think that's likely to be an option for this particular hypothetical patient. So for her, what I would do would be first make sure that I have all of my appropriate vasopressor and inotropic agents going, and I might even bump them up a little bit in anticipation of her becoming hypotensive with the intubation. For the intubating agent, I think that this would be a great time to use Etomidate, and if she doesn't have any contraindications, using succinylcholine is totally reasonable as well. We could use a little bit of fentanyl to try to see if we could maybe try to stave off a little bit of hypertension if we're able to do it. Or I'm sorry, the tachycardia if we're able to do it early. And I don't know. I don't really know how much that really helps. Sometimes I use it as an additional adjunct since Etomidate isn't always a super powerful anesthetic agent, as the anesthesiologist will say. So getting her... taking her through the RSI, you'd want to have your best, fastest intubator, because you don't really want to be the one where you're having to stop, bag, reassess, and kind of mess around before you get the tube in place. Once you do get the tube in, this again, it's not somebody that you'd want to start to either hyper or hypoventilate. I would try to get her on the ventilator as fast as possible. Focus on low tidal volume ventilation, because you don't want to increase her intrathoracic pressure any more than you have to. And whereas I love PEEP, this would be the time where I would certainly want to try to keep her on the lowest possible PEEP. And probably start with 5 and not do anything more than that if I can avoid it with her hypoxemia with the pneumonia, since we really don't want to increase her intrathoracic pressure any more than we have to. And she would definitely be somebody that I would want to be checking frequent ABGs on to kind of see where we are with everything, and then titrating our vasoactive agents as we need to.
Brilliant. And one other idea I will pose and see what you think about it is... one way I've handled this in the past is a combination of ketamine and fentanyl for a ketamine-facilitated awake intubation, leaving the patient spontaneously breathing throughout. What is your feelings on that?
Oh, I love ketamine. I feel like I don't know. When I was coming up through residency, we almost never used it. And I love this resurgence of ketamine. I think that's a great idea. Going to be more hemodynamically stabilizing, letting her breathe. I think that's great.
All right. Is there one tip you want to give people from your article that it would be a take-home point for them if they had to read it, and this is the thing you really want them to get out of it?
I would say be aware of the pulmonary hypertension. I know that sounds really vague, but again, I think that a lot of people don't have it on their differential, don't worry about it when they're getting ready to intubate or resuscitate a patient, or don't realize how hemodynamically devastating it can be for a patient, whether they present with a complication from the pulmonary hypertension or anything else. Being aware that this is a real problem and that it's probably more prevalent than we've previously recognized would be the most important thing I'd want people to take away.
Love it. So respect the RV. It's the Rodney Dangerfield of the cardiac world, but it deserves the respect because it will kill your patient. I love it. Susan, thank you. Thank you. This was perfect.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on.